It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
You may have noticed that some buildings in Salisbury are sporting some murals. They're called public art. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Large and small cities have become a little more colorful these days as a trend for adding large painted murals on the sides of buildings takes hold. Cincinnati, Ohio has employed teens to paint murals, having completed some 90 of them since the mid-1990s. Aside from the artistic quality of these works, there is also a sense that they enrich and bring the communities together. In our studio this morning is Mayor Jake Day, who has spent a good deal of time looking at city planning long before he took the job as the city's chief executive. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Don.
So before we get into a couple of the murals, what's your overall philosophy about having these kind of murals? What kind of contribution do you think that they make to the community?
That's the critical question, right? It's not necessarily that we need to have debates about the content or anything like that, and we can. But the critical question is, what is the overall contribution? The overall contribution is beautification. And there are so many ways to contribute to beautification and to create places that people appreciate and ultimately fall in love with. That's everything from placemaking, creating spaces or, through urban design that are enjoyable, that are playful, that are fun, that are human scaled, that have interesting things to do in them and interesting things happening around them and attract people to them. It's the buildings themselves, creating beautiful buildings and creating sites that are attractive and have lots of activity going on in them. And then lastly, taking spaces that are essentially blank canvases, for lack of a better term, and contributing art to them. And whether that's sculpture, whether that's painted mural, I mean, that's really less important than the fact that you're adding positive and interesting things to look at and appreciate to the built environment.
Because one of the things, as a matter of fact, looking at the history of this, I mean, some of the mural stuff actually reaches back into the WPA project, the Great Depression, that this there's a long history of this.
That's right. And stylistically, some of the best and most interesting murals that, known in America, I mean, whether it's in, train stations, whether it's in public squares, or whether it's just iconography, things that we're familiar with seeing, even if we don't know where it's from, are from that era.
So you have, of course, talked a little bit about this. What kind of things do you look for when it comes to having public art in terms of the kinds of things they display?
Yeah. Well, I'm a firm believer in the mayor shouldn't choose art, and that the government, shouldn't be in the business of determining what's good art and what's not. So we work with Salisbury Arts and Entertainment District. We work with artists in the community. We work with neighborhood groups to identify what they want. And groups that are willing to, frankly, put some effort into it, whether that's fundraising, whether that's participating in the actual artistry, the painting. We recently had a new crosswalk project completed, and it's water. It's a crosswalk that's painted blue with waves and ripples through it, The folks that proposed it did it, and that's the most beautiful thing, because it's not, hey, I came to you with an idea. It's I came to you with an idea that I just want permission for, and then I'm going to make it happen. And that's the most exciting thing, I think. But the government has been in the position periodically of facilitating and encouraging certain projects, some of them that serve, I think in each case, it serves more purpose than just the art. So the Riverwalk steel sculpture, for example, at the amphitheater. And part of the purpose there is to create a visual barrier as a backdrop to the amphitheater itself, between the highway above and the amphitheater below. Another example is the Church Street mural. And the Church Street mural, that's not just art. It's art plus what I think of as urban acupuncture. So taking a very small spot and project and trying to make a very significant change by making that dynamic difference in that space, which meant, going out and doing a public process, public competition, design competition with artists, engaging the community in feedback and a dialogue about what they wanted to see. That wasn't selected by a mayor or a council. That was selected by the neighborhood.
So it's better, speaking of the Church Street mural, it features a number of people who are important to the community. In fact, as I was reminded of a little time ago, that these people represent actually a community to a large extent has actually almost virtually disappeared in terms of what used to be a rather thriving African-American community.
That's right. You got a neighborhood that's gone. You know, the Georgetown neighborhood, which once stood essentially from the facade on which the mural is painted to Lot 10 in downtown, was the Georgetown neighborhood. It was sort of the western end of, the eastern end of the downtown area today. And, you know, largely carved out in the late 50s and early 60s by urban renewal efforts, which is what the federal government termed the programs that paid for the acquisition and demolition of houses and what they considered to be blighted or slum properties and replaced with highways. I think today we see that that's rarely the right approach to urban revitalization and development. Doesn't mean that buildings don't need to be torn down. Sure, they do. Of course they do. But that's not the only thing that we should be doing. And we should be salvaging what we can. You know, the very things that we appreciate most as a society are the things that have some history to them. And if we can protect those and use those as we build new and as we add new and as we, you know, progress as a society, that makes for an even richer environment and urban experience. But at that location, you know, they wiped it out. And what we were left with was some buildings that were in okay shape, and then one or two that are in great shape, like the building upon which this mural now rests. And the city bought a building that stood in the way of that right. blank facade. And it was the building that housed the shop Sextile,
right.
which is, you know, at the intersection of your busiest two highways in your city, not really what you want as like the welcoming sign to your community. I don't know, maybe some communities do. Ours, I don't. Right. I think, doesn't or didn't. And so we acquired this. The person who bought it offered it at a steep discount to the city. We rarely accept property that we have to pay for, but we saw an opportunity and we said, yes, we bought it. We tore it down and we turned it into a little neighborhood pocket park and a gateway site. You know, there's a little area to sit. A lot of community members participated in that process, not only what they wanted to see there, but also actually doing their work and getting their hands dirty, you know, from businesses like Lowe's to people in the neighborhood to various city departments. I mean, they all participated in making this happen. And what we did was we went to the neighborhood and we did door hangers and we said, we're going to have an event. Please come out and tell us what you want to see. We're going to do a mural and we're going to pay for it. And we want to know what you want on the wall. And so people came out and we gave them pieces of paper and with a drawing of the facade. And we did, we had a couple of historians speak. We had some group discussion about what people remembered from the old neighborhood that was there and from the Church Street neighborhood where this is a gateway into. And we said, what do you want to see? And so people started sketching and writing and drawing. And ultimately, the groups made presentations to each other. And then we took that content and we put it all out on the internet. And we said, we're looking for an artist to turn this into a mural. Here's some of the content we're looking for. And ultimately, Paul Boyd Sketch was selected as the artist and just did a fantastic job. I mean, he's a talented guy, a hardworking artist, and did an amazing job capturing what the community wanted. They people all seemed to focus on the trains, on the idea that there were once passenger trains that came through here, you know, which I think people also would love to see again, but
that may be, yes.
But maybe, you know, but what he did was he put young children in there. He made it really colorful. And then he put the history up above and, you know, blue sky. And he took these five figures, these African-American leaders in their time that were talked about prominently in this discussion with community members. And they said, hey, that's who we want to celebrate. You know, if the mayor had done it, that may have been a mural about Frederick Douglass, you know, or you know, Harriet Tubman. It may have been, you know, something that really just didn't speak to people the way that a collective effort identified those who were important. And you know, it's sort of just a stunning example of listening to people and hearing what's important to them and then following through on that.
And there are a number of people that you have up there. To speak to some of them, there's obviously Sergeant William Butler, who was a World War I hero. Charles Chipman also has a center named after him, was a principal educator. Lane Brown, also a high school teacher. James Stewart, who was actually African-American community mortician, and Dr. G. Herbert Simley, who practiced medicine for about 60 years. Tell me a little bit about what did you have a learning experience when they came up with these names and learning more about them?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a person in our area who hasn't heard Charles Chipman's name or his family's name. And probably there's not a person who doesn't know about the center that's right there that is bears his name. But you know, some of the other folks in there, I got to hear stories from former Councilwoman Shaney Shields about Elaine Brown. I got to hear stories from current Councilwoman April Jackson about Dr. Sembley and, you know, the impact he had on the African-American community as a doctor, a practicing physician in our area. Delegate Cherie Sample Hughes, now our Speaker pro tem of the Maryland House of Delegates. This is an Eastern Shore delegate who's risen to an incredibly high position in the state. She talked about the impact that not only Mr. Stewart's practice had, but morticians in general, and the prominent role that they've had on shaping her life and shaping the lives of others. And then I just think anytime I can hear people who know the stories or have heard the stories passed down about William Butler, that's a powerful thing.
Right.
This is a man who would have almost certainly been awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions, for his heroism and his bravery, conspicuous gallantry, as they say, in World War I, were it not for the color of his skin and the way that our American government treated our African-American war veterans at the time. And so to know that he is now on a wall and that people like Senator Chris Van Hollen are out there fighting in Congress right now to have his medals upgraded, his Distinguished Service Cross, which is incredible enough as it is, but to have that upgraded to a Medal of Honor is a pretty proud thing. And it's hard for me not to drive past there and think about that when I look at his face.
Do you think that people who do not come from this area will understand the significance of those images, or how does that relate? I mean, because I've been to other cities where you drive by, I mean, street names and just for openers. I mean, that's true, particularly Los Angeles, where I come from, where, you know, you drive down Temple Street and you later find out it's actually named after a failed banker. I mean, it's so just to give you an example. I know there's there are certainly political figures as well.
What I think is we're going to help that process along. One of the things that I'm announcing in the next week is the creation, and I've already created it, but it's going to be announced. We haven't put it out there. The Historical Marker Task Force. Hmm. The Historical Marker Task Force, led by Linda Dwyer, a well-known historian in the area and author, she and her team of, I think it's nine members, seven or nine members, they are going about the process of mapping, and they have mapped over 300 significant incidents, moments, places that deserve recognition in Salisbury. And then they are, and that's all mapped on GIS now. And then they are working to create the content and the standard template for design of a series of historical markers that will be all over our city. We think it's an important thing to do to acknowledge the history and to help people see that Salisbury is not, you know, some city that sprang up out of the ground 50 years ago. I mean, that we have centuries of interesting history here, and that it ought to be celebrated, and we ought to talk about it. We're not far. We're what, a little more than a decade from 300 years since the settlement of this community. So there's some things that are worth talking about and worth learning about. So one of the things that we're going to do is, and it's already been designed, is put our first, one of our first historical markers right at the foot of this mural, which will give people a sense of, you know, what was, why were these five people selected? How were they selected? What did the community see that was significant about their history that it ought to be up on a wall, 35 feet in the air?
There's another mural, which I guess it's, I believe, it's on the Delmarva Veteran Builders structure there, the new home for them. Tell me a little bit about how that came about, and describe the mural, by the way, itself.
Well, the Believe mural is, as you said, on the Delmarva Veteran Builders headquarters in downtown Salisbury, which is one of the old Peninsula Insurance buildings. If people aren't familiar with Delmarva Veteran Builders, this is a business that has come up in the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, but was one of the Inc. 5000 fastest growing companies in America last year. This is a company that's grown by leaps and bounds. And you can see that as they filled out this rather large building in downtown Salisbury. And on the wall, and this is a vertical surface that's perpendicular to Market Street. As you're headed eastbound in downtown Salisbury on Market Street, you'll pass by this thing. Right across the street is the city-owned parking garage. A work of art in itself. Right. Yeah, to some. And the Believe mural is this black wall with the word Believe written on it, and a little girl blowing a flower, and just every color in the rainbow on this flower. And it is just this splash of color that's absolutely beautiful. And the cool thing about how this was done by Desiree and Brandon, the artists, is that they asked people to come participate. So you could go and paint. So I actually took my daughters, Lily and Olivia, and we each painted one of the petals or part of one of the petals on the Believe mural. And the neat thing is, you know, it's going to last. I mean, even without a touch up, I'm sure it would last 30 some years. And I'm sure it will also be touched up or, you know, improved at some point if it needs it. So my kids are going to, you know, be adults and be able to see that and say, when I was a little girl, I painted a part of that mural. So it's the artists went beyond over and above what I think they had to do by trying to draw people in and say, you can participate in this art. And I thought that was really special.
What was it like to be part of painting this mural, which, as you suggest, will probably last for a long time, they usually do. And the fact that, yes, that you have your child helping you out.
Well, I got to tell you, you know, it was in the middle of the election, so I was busy. You know what's important, and it's like, okay, I got to get over there, and I'll bring the kids, and, you know, we're in a rush, and, you know, we get there, and then you get a paintbrush in your hand, and it's a different feeling entirely. It's, you know, time kind of slows down, and it's like, oh, this is what's important. And so we got to play and laugh, and they had their kids there running around. So it was a family experience. And those are the moments, I think, that also help you to fall in love with a place. You know, we're in downtown Salisbury, which when I was a kid, you know, the thing that made me feel like it was special was it was where you went to get your haircut and where you bought your shoes for school. But the truth is, there wasn't much else going on. I didn't have many other reasons to fall in love with downtown. And I like that, you know, my kids will have a story where they participated in something that was creative and memorable in the sense that they're not likely to do that too many other times in their life.
We now turn to Brandon Bell and Desiree Martin, who created the large mural. So what was the inspiration for the mural and the idea about Believe?
We were introduced to Chris Eccleston. He gave us an opportunity to work on a building because he was looking for a mural artist. We weren't technically mural artists, but we have children. And that would definitely be the inspiration right there. The little girl that's on the building is our daughter, and she's 6 years old. He believed in us. We believed in ourselves. We believe in our children. Our children believe in us, and that pushed us to create something together, really magnificent, really big, and it's been a stepping stone. It's gotten us to get other gigs, get other things based off of that. People have, you know, been really touched by the word Believe, touched by this little girl blowing a dandelion into a flower, and then this arrangement of flowers on the wall that is just growing.
If I may, we are essentially Chris myself, Desiree, we all shared, like, as most people, we know we deal with hardships, struggles, and things like that. Chris has a huge personal belief in just the concept of believing itself and believing in the impossible, believing in the unseen, believing in you can achieve your dreams and aspirations. So when he reached out to us to do this, that was something that was like a common principle that we even shared ourselves amongst our, like, we believe that we were able to do a lot of things we put our minds to. We knew we've never done a mural like this of this size, but we knew we could do it. He believed in us. And that whole idea was like, this is something that we know that our idea of believing in ourselves, we've seen ourselves go from, you know, if you will, rock bottom to sky high. So it's like we wanted to instill that in the community as best as we could. And we did it with, hopefully, in a very artistic way. But we just want everybody to know with that piece that you've got to believe. If you want to make an impact, you want to make a change, you want to make something happen, you got to first step is believing it's possible.
Now, the mayor has obviously described the mural itself. Where did the idea of having this young girl essentially blowing it on a flower?
It came after many renditions. It wasn't just the original first idea. We did a back and forth with Chris of our first idea. He kind of gave us an idea. We jumped on it. We mixed and matched. Eventually, we ended up with this. It's kind of funny, but the final result was almost the very kind of first idea we kind of had. And it was just, it's a very whimsical piece, if you will. She, you know, she's essentially, it's almost like making a wish. You know, children are very, it's kind of like a common theme we've seen, which is children especially picking up dandelions and things of various other flowers, blowing them. Usually they're instructed by an adult at some point, probably pick up one, make a wish. So we wanted to do essentially combine that concept of our little girl who's constantly saying what she wants to do, what she believes in, and basically trying to showing that you make a wish and it can turn into a beautiful piece, which is the flowers on the side of you, a beautiful piece of work if you let it.
So what is your daughter said? Is she aware of what's going on?
She is. She's starting to understand that she's a little kid that's on the side of the wall, and not many people have that experience. I don't think it's really hit her yet, but she does appreciate it, and especially when it was in the progress. You know, we had events going on, like the National Folk Festival, and people would stop by and be like, oh my goodness, this is the little girl that's on the
Yeah, she had no problem telling people either.
Yeah.
That's me.
And
that's me.
The mayor, that was one of the people that she was like, this is me. That's me on the wall.
Yeah, they had a chance to meet outside of it one day. The mayor came by with his two daughters because we had a community flower. So we let everybody, we try to let as many people as we know to come out for various nights to paint a piece of it, to add to it. So the community could kind of add their own little touch to it. We left one sunflower blank. The mayor came by with his two children and Addie had a chance to meet him right then and there. And it was really cool. They got a photo taken and it was just perfect timing kind of thing. Because Addie just so happened to be out there that same day with us. Couldn't bring her every time.
So what do you hope to have come out of this in terms of the community, in terms of people seeing it, and an impact on the community? Do you think it'll have an impact?
Definitely
believe that there's an impact. I think there already has been one. We are very, very involved with the youth and the idea of what can come from this next generation, and she has definitely showed us that, you know, it doesn't take an adult to know, it doesn't take you being an adult to know what you want to do. It's like little kids already have it in them. I want to do this, I want to be this, and if we can push that and get them to see that and believe in them, I think that helps boost their boost their morale and get them, you know, to want to do the things that they're ready to do. She's the kind of kid that I guess she can, I don't know, just do things that
I was going to say more than
very
just
creative.
Sorry. More than just children, like the whole idea, the piece itself, believe. We want the community to like know, like this, hopefully this giant piece being put up by, you know, thanks to Chris, hopefully shows people the belief that your city, like people, you should be proud where you're from. There is a lot of good things happening and taking place, and this is hopefully like a visual representation of like just keep up, keep believing. Like we've talked about before, we've talked about relocating. We both have lived across the country and we've made our way back here, and we've made a firm commitment to like neither of us were born here, but we love it here, we want to raise a family here, and we believe in the area enough to know that we can make a change. And effectively, like, it's, you take your problems with you. Why not take where you are from, put your flag in the ground, and make it as best as you can? So
it's kind of starting on a blank canvas. You know, we have this big, huge wall that we got to take a piece of ourselves, where we are, Salisbury, Maryland, and put some of us there. And in a way that gets to unite the community, that gets to unite us with the community. That's a piece of us that's always going to be on that wall, or for as long as, you know, Chris decides to keep it up there. And the steps that it took along the way to get us to get that piece, to work as a team, like that's, I mean, we didn't know what was going to come of this. And there were definitely ups and downs, like he had mentioned before. But the children, you know, I think the colors, it's something that kind of has like this black and white feel, but also has color and beauty into it. And it's children kind of give us that, that reality to see things that are, you know, black and white and gray and add that extra spark of color to it, you know. And sometimes it just takes a blow of a dandelion or just catching yourself in the moment of watching a child and see what, you know, can blossom and grow from that. And it's been a very great experience too.
Is there a cohesiveness to these murals and artwork?
It's a great question. There is cohesiveness in that you need more than one or two to have created a changed landscape. Right. But there is not thematic cohesiveness. And I think that's desirable, there not being thematic cohesiveness. Because I wouldn't want us to get into a mindset that this should be a government project, because government projects have a way of becoming stale and stuck in time. And so my instinct is certainly to be programmatic and focused about it, which, you know, you could see that in Urban Salisbury's steel sculpture efforts. There are 9 steel sculptures on posts around downtown, and they are individually attractive. They help create a sense of cohesion. But I think if that was the only way that we allowed art to be in downtown, it would get very boring very quickly. And so instead, the murals, they're not connected necessarily in their content. And let me not forget the very challenging process that we as a community went through to paint books on the side of the library as a mural years ago. There was a lot of pushback on that from the Historic District Commission at the time, as, you know, we can't allow this sort of thing. What could it lead to? And look, you know, art's blossoming all over, you know, like little flowers around downtown.
We've been speaking with first Mayor Jake Day about the murals going up in Salisbury, as well as Brandon Bell and Desiree Martin, who created the mural Believe on the side of the Delmarva Veteran Builders' new home on East Market Street in downtown. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Is the end of the 18-year war in Afghanistan in sight? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The Taliban have announced a nationwide temporary ceasefire during which a peace agreement could be signed with the United States. U.S. currently has around 12,000 troops in the country, but during its time in Afghanistan, U.S. lost some 2,400 troops, with thousands more suffering from the after effects of their service there. So what went wrong? Why has the U.S. been in the country for nearly two decades? The Washington Post recently published what it called the Afghanistan Papers. It's drawn from a study by the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction titled Lessons Learned. And the $11 million study conducted interviews with 600 people, compiling some 2,000 pages. On the phone with us this morning is Anthony Cordesman. He's with the Center for Strategic and International Studies based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So let me just first of all begin with the latest news, which is a ceasefire. Apparently has been declared, at least approved by the Taliban Council. And there's a lot of talk about some kind of peace deal, perhaps the U.S. pulling out. What do you make of that flurry of recent news?
Well, this is actually a process of negotiation that's been going on for several years and which has culminated really in about a year of effort. The problem is it defines a temporary ceasefire. There's been no public statement of what the peace terms would be, what role the Taliban would play in the Afghan government, and no one knows what the Afghan government will be because there's been an election which has not produced a clear result. And where there is even more bitterness and division between the two main candidates than the last time. There's been no definition of what role the United States would play, if any, in continuing to provide aid or security guarantees if the Taliban broke the terms of any agreement. And again, that's important to stress. There's been no public statement of what the agreement would be and whether it would guarantee any of the rights that have gradually at least made some progress, like the rights of women, the rule of law, efforts to limit corruption. All of these issues are kind of left hanging, waiting to see if you can actually negotiate any kind of peace settlement. And usually when you have any kind of ceasefire, you have an agreement as to what the peace is going to be first, at least what the ceasefire would be on any lasting basis. Here, we really don't know anything about how this is going to end.
Do you see any kind of reconciliation between the Afghan government on the one hand that the U.S. produced and the Taliban on the other?
Well, as yet, there has been no reconciliation. Technically speaking, the Taliban has moved to the point where it will at least talk to the Afghan government. But it's important to note that, technically speaking, there is not an Afghan government. The people holding office have held office now long after their elected terms. No one knows how this is going to work out because no one knows what the results of the recent election are going to be. There are certainly deep factional divisions within Afghanistan, so when we talk about the government of Afghanistan, it's a government of about half the country, and sometimes it's the government of what people call Kabulistan, after the capital, rather than the Afghan government. So all of these uncertainties are critical, and there's a tendency to ignore them. And it's one that's very dangerous, because this is a country which exists largely because of outside aid, military and civilian. It can't finance the government it has to the extent it has a government. And to the extent that its military forces can survive, they have been almost completely dependent on U.S. ground advisors and U.S. air power.
So where did this thing go wrong? I mean, as I could have looked back at 9/11, Afghanistan was clearly a response to that. And it's almost as if Osama bin Laden opened up a trap. That is to say that the United States, at least it seemed to feel as if it had no recourse except to invade the country, which then made the Taliban the enemy, amongst other things, and that the mission became a rather obscure in terms of actually finding Osama bin Laden, which was the actual object.
I think a lot of what you say is perfectly true. The problem you have is the history really is extremely erratic. We went in with very small forces and air power. We basically tied ourselves to a northern alliance, which was still fighting the Taliban. The Taliban had no ability to resist American air power and the unlimited number of American ground advisors, which included many special forces and people from the CIA, were able to organize the Northern Alliance forces to drive the Taliban out and push it across into Pakistan. Now, one of the problems was that bin Laden and many of the forces that were involved basically made it to Pakistan. Another problem was that others dispersed. It was really hard to say after the Taliban government broke up who was really a supporter of the Taliban. The United States was confronted with a deeply divided country because the Northern Alliance did not speak for or include large numbers of people from a major faction in Afghanistan, which were the Pashtuns. And you had an economy in almost total collapse, a government basically that didn't really function in the normal sense. It didn't provide basic medical or educational or other services. So we walk into a power vacuum. Now, initially, the Taliban was so disrupted, there was no military resistance. But all of a sudden, the United States was confronted with nation building. And the nation we tried to build, in many ways, was a copy of ourselves. We tried to leap from essentially a semi-feudal tribal structure to a modern democratic government by passing a constitution, which we in many ways drafted. It had many deep errors in it. We had a foreign aid program, but nobody really knew enough about Afghanistan to plan one. And we didn't pay a lot of attention to creating effective Afghan forces for the first few years because the Taliban had been so thoroughly disrupted. And then, remember, this is 2001, 2002. And in 2003, we invaded Iraq. Now, this is something the Post doesn't pay any attention to, and frankly, in fairness to the Special Inspector General, the lead Inspector General, their reports do pay attention to it. But once we became involved in Iraq, we were suddenly faced with a far more serious problem and a much quicker rise of an opposition force. That led to a focus on Iraq to the exclusion in many ways of a focus on Afghanistan. And so roughly between 2003 and really 2006-2007, the Taliban kind of came back while we kept trying to essentially transform Afghanistan into something that it simply wasn't ready to be transformed into. When the Taliban did come back, we were simply not in a position to provide the trainers and aid necessary to create an effective Afghan force. So for years, we relied on our own forces, and NATO allies. That takes us really up to somewhere about 2012. Then we went from having the impression of having won in Iraq in 2011 to a surge. We, in the process, created a massive aid program, but it was extremely unstable, basically changing every year. And the president announced a deadline for leaving. Well, the problem with that deadline was we couldn't possibly create effective Afghan forces in the time that was left. And it told the Taliban if they simply waited, the U.S. would be withdrawing most of its combat forces. And again, this is not covered well in the Post, but every year from about 2014 through about 2017, we kept changing tactics, withdrawing forces, altering the force mix. We basically let the civil aid, the nation-building efforts, almost vanish. It looks like a mountain of rising aid up to about 2013, and then all of a sudden the mountain ends and falls down into a valley and almost disappears. And this structure had no continuity. Now, people who are listening to this broadcast who are old enough will remember that one of the slogans in Vietnam, because every year we rotated, changed policies, was that every year in Vietnam was the first year in Vietnam. And if you look at the programs, the funding profiles, the tactics, the way we tried to build up the government and Afghan forces, One problem was that this cycle of rapid rotations meant every year was the first year in Afghanistan. Now, basically, we don't advise the Afghan security forces that are police or paramilitary. We concentrate on advancing the army and trying to develop that using advisors now, which are forward, not simply in the rear, but there are very few of them, and we rely basically on massive numbers of U.S. airstrikes to give the Afghan army the ability to defend the population centers, because it can't defend much of the countryside.
Let me ask you this. Going back, it seems to me that to a large extent, one of the basic flaws was that on the one hand, we, as you said, drew up this sort of U.S. style kind of constitution, at least the concepts. On the other hand, we were very dependent upon the warlords, which created its own constituency and was certainly not compatible with this ideal constitution.
Well, it certainly wasn't compatible, but the Constitution, frankly, was ridiculous. We made the same mistake in Iraq. Instead of creating a constitution where people voted for representatives, they voted for national lists. The idea was this would get around all of the tribal and sectarian differences. And warlords were only a limited part of the problem. Generally, the problem wasn't warlords. It was power brokers and drug retailers. But the legislature had no real power over money, and it didn't really represent anybody. The role of Karzai, to some extent Ghani, was not simply to deal with warlords, which were a problem mostly in the north, but the whole host of power brokers and sectarian and ethnic leaders. And in one city, for example, like Kandahar, you ended up with 12 rival factions in the city, and they weren't even basically divided by tribe or sect or ethnicity. You had no coherent structure for governance, and you had no control over money. And this, I think, is another key issue, and it is raised often in the outside criticisms by the special inspector and other inspector generals as well as the post. You created a level of corruption which to Americans is almost unimaginable. We know of a lot of low-level corruption. We don't think of it as consuming perhaps 20% of the entire economy. And in Afghanistan, corruption was so great that it basically took over much of the country.
In terms of that aid, it seemed to me that one of the things that happens is that there is, I think, and you alluded to a moment ago, that there is so much aid, so much money flowing in, probably not as many projects as perhaps were appropriate, and there was no way to figure out how to get that aid effectively to build those projects without a lot of it just simply being siphoned off.
Well, part of the problem, frankly, was that we hadn't engaged in any kind of serious nation building for decades. So USAID and the State Department basically concentrated on two types of aid. One was project aid, which didn't really reform or change the economy. And the country was divided up into districts where every major ally ran their own aid program. In theory, it was to be coordinated by the UN, but the UN never really tried to coordinate this aid. And we didn't have consistent patterns. We had very low-level aid, and as it became apparent that there were serious problems, we just had a massive rise in funding, and this is shown in a lot of graphs in the Special Inspector General's report. And then just about 2012-2013, we slashed the programs without really having planned ways to terminate them. And a lot of the money was wasted on really ineffective efforts to do things like prevent the growing of narcotics. when you look at how these funding profiles related to what actually got done, the other issue was that you didn't really have an effort to control the money. I think people rushed to try to accomplish as much as possible, as quickly as possible, and the end result was they made the funding almost too easy to steal, to misuse, to misallocate, or waste. It was only really after General McChrystal came there, and then General McMaster began to do a study of how bad the contracting procedure was, and this is more than a decade after we went into the country, that people noticed how bad the funding and contract control was, and we left before we had the ability to actually implement the reforms in that contracting process.
One of the other issues that's taken up, particularly in terms of the papers that the Washington Post published, was the issue of opium, which apparently under the Taliban had almost been wiped out, but then came surging back. Tell me a little bit about that and what seemed to be a lot of contradictions in how we approached Afghanistan.
Well, I think one problem to understand is there was exactly 1 year that the Taliban really seriously cut back on opium. And it did so as much because the previous year, under Taliban rule, the flood of opium into the world market had depressed the price as any great moral crusade. The fact was that opium was virtually the only major export of Afghanistan. It was the only way that farmers could actually get a cash crop. There wasn't the distribution or food processing to handle a lot of the things that they grew normally and that were food products, and sort of earn money from markets outside in incredibly poor Afghanistan. And we tried everything. We tried to find alternative crops. We tried to destroy the opium poppy crops that were grown. We created anti-drug forces. But the basic problem was that when this is the only way to get real money, and when people, quite aside from the farmers, have every incentive to become drug dealers, particularly not only the Taliban, but the power brokers, a lot of these efforts to stop opium growing simply defied virtually every economic incentive in the country.
Do you think that that there was any way for the United States to accomplish its mission, or to keep from its mission from creeping, as it were, from essentially searching for Osama bin Laden to the nation building of Afghanistan?
I don't think that there was ever any chance, and we're seeing this in Iraq right now, that we could transform Afghanistan from a country that had basically been involved in civil conflicts since the late 1970s into anything approaching a modern state. If we had basically tried to use the Northern Alliance, rely on the real structure of power, create a legislature that had some ability to represent and control money, and if we had actually created any kind of effective international system to allocate much more limited levels of aid in the areas which were most needed, we might at least have brought stability. If we had basically seriously tried to resource the creation of effective Afghan forces rather than deploy a mix of our own forces and allied forces, and done that early on, we might have created a force that could actually have defended at least the major population centers. But I think, and this puts it in perspective, I think, for at least some of you listeners, you have to remember this was one, and is one, of the poorest countries in the world. We normally think of poverty in terms of countries like Bangladesh, but Bangladesh is rich compared to Afghanistan. We're talking tremendous levels of dire poverty affecting 30 to 40% of the population. We're talking a country which war has forced to urbanize in areas where there's no industry and there are no real jobs, and where young men basically can't find employment and women aren't allowed to. We're talking about a structure where if you want to earn a modern living, you almost have to be corrupt and deal with the power brokers. And if you're going to deal with a country like this, you don't try to transform it quickly. You move it very slowly and according to its own capabilities and priorities. And even then, when you look at countries like Afghanistan that are that poor, you find that basically many of them have had terrible development records for decades and haven't been able to deal with peacetime, much less war, conflict in a neighbor like Pakistan. And I think it's important to point out that throughout this, Pakistan basically supported the Taliban while it simultaneously claimed to be helping the United States reach a peace settlement. A problem which, to go back to your original questions, one of the great difficulties here is nobody has said a word about what Pakistan's role has been in this peace settlement.
Is there any way to deal with Pakistan in terms of the kind of government that would then be formed in Afghanistan as we go ahead? What kind of what kind of influence do they have in terms of how it's going to look?
I think it's in many ways too late. Originally, there was some very hard negotiating, and there were, to put it simply, statements that you're either with us or against us, and then we provided very high levels of military aid to a military-dominated Pakistan. That bought time, but it never basically bought support. Pakistan was far more interested in ensuring that India didn't gain influence in Pakistan, that it maintained control over its western border, that it didn't have to accept the boundary with Pakistan, which is not one Pakistan accepts. And we, if we had leverage, we had it early on. Once we announced that we were leaving, which of course we didn't really completely do, we didn't just send signals to the Taliban. We told Pakistan, basically, that we weren't going to be there and we weren't going to be able to put real pressure on Pakistan.
Ultimately, do you see the United States pulling out within the next few years?
I think that the way we are going, if the Taliban can find the unity to actually reach a peace agreement, I think we're going to learn the hard way that peace negotiations are often a form of war by other means. The Taliban will inherit some kind of role formally in governing at the local level, probably over about half the country, although not the most populated part. It will have to be given ministries and roles inside the government, and it will not have to effectively disarm, because frankly, in a country where everyone basically who's male and under 40 has an AK-47 or its equivalent, you're not going to disarm the Taliban under any conditions. They basically will have considerable advantages in transforming this peace into at least some level of control over much of the country. Now, since we don't know the terms of the peace, we don't know what protections or safeguards are going to be involved, if any. We don't know if the U.S. is guaranteeing prolonged military aid to what emerges as an Afghan government. And of course, we also have the minor problem that, legally speaking, at this point in time, there is no Afghan government, at least one that's accepted by at least a safe majority of the people. So you have the oddity that the Taliban is essentially negotiating with the U.S., which is to some extent excluded the titular head of the Afghan government, President Ghani, from much of these negotiations. And kind of in trying to predict this future, well, it's a bit difficult.
We'll be speaking with Anthony Cordesman. He's with the Center for Strategic and International Studies based in Washington, D.C., and we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us this morning. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.